Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week I'm speaking to Sarah Hall. Sarah Hall is a novelist and short story writer. Her novel, The Electric Michelangelo, was nominated for the 2004 Man Booker Prize, and she is the first writer to win the National Short Story Award twice. Her novel, Burnt Coat, was published in October.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we're here to talk about your novel, Burnt Coat, which was published by Faber in October in the UK and November in the US, so just last year. It tells the story of Edith Harkness, a sculptor who lives above her studio somewhere in Scotland, and she is remembering her life as she is in the final days before she knows she is about to die. She's dying of a relapse from a virus she caught during a pandemic not entirely unlike our own, except the virus is a lot worse, more virulent and more contagious. So obviously writing about a pandemic whilst living in a pandemic must have been quite difficult. What was it like being inspired by current events?
Well, in some ways it was, maybe it was even a coping mechanism, because the book was really started the first day of the first lockdown in March 2020. And I suppose we were all getting to grips with how we felt about the current situation and all our anxieties and fears. But I also wanted to try and look around the corners of what was this huge event, you know, probably one of the biggest events of my lifetime, certainly. And I think a lot of people would say that if you hadn't lived through a war, this was going to be the kind of major event that meant that the country was grinding to a halt and also focusing on one thing particularly. My response was immediately, well, somehow I have to respond myself to this. And I was not inspired exactly, but just, I felt compelled to work. I think that was the main point. And the story seemed to come quite quickly. So I was pulling in the kind of current events, the current speculations, certainly the current feelings of anxiety and uncertainty, but also the positive responses that people were having to the situation. And just trying to kind of use that to buoy up a story which was other. You know, it certainly wasn't anything happening at the time. So there was this strange mix of completely fabricated, but also completely realistic in terms of everything that was floating around in society.
I think that's so, so interesting. What I really picked up when I was reading your novel is the tiny details. You describe Edith going into a coffee shop and she automatically puts on her mask, and then somebody says, oh, you don't have to if you don't want to. It's a kind of concession to the fact that she may not want to wear it anymore. And the details about queuing for food, although it's quite a lot more extreme in your novel. How is it balancing the fictional and the more intense version of the pandemic with the tiny, very, very real details? It's kind of like the uncanny. There's something really, really familiar and incredibly unfamiliar as well at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. And I think those strange things that we were being asked to do, because of course in this country we're not really used to wearing masks, but it wasn't it strange how quickly it became normal? So I think, you know, just pulling in those details which were unusual for perhaps a week or two. I mean, perhaps lots of people might still feel that it's not normal behavior. I think it has been metabolized into the way we operate now, so lots of people would find it normal. But I wanted those little strange details to be in there, because I think, you know, they were so much greater than the sum of their parts. You know, it's putting on a mask, but actually, as we know, there are huge debates around masks now, and I suppose there always have been, but that one simple act is a political act in some ways. It's a social act, it's a personal act. So those little things are important, and they were important to put into the book because they were so much more meaningful than just the simple little thing itself. And, you know, I suppose maybe it's a question of relativity. I didn't want to write a journalistic piece about what was going on in the here and now. That's not where my strengths are. I think I'm more of, if not a catastrophist, then somebody that recognises that an amplified situation will really examine the sort of public response in a very detailed way. So if you push human beings to the furthest edges of what they're capable of, very interesting behaviours and capabilities are exposed. And that's generally what I tend to do. But because I was amplifying the pandemic and creating a virus that's much worse than coronavirus, It was interesting, and it wasn't exactly consoling for me, but it really put things a bit more into perspective that, yes, we were in this dreadful situation. And it is dreadful. You know, my father passed away from COVID. I've had it, and I had it extremely badly. We've lost, you know, hundreds and thousands of people to this virus, and it is bad. But it's not as bad as it could be. There are certainly viruses sitting in reservoirs waiting to jump, which will be far worse. And so in some ways you do put it into perspective that, yes, there was this huge event, and as I say, probably one of the biggest events of my lifetime, but also on the scale of things, I can't say was it really so bad. I don't mean that at all. I just mean it's a way of kind of putting it into context, and perhaps I needed that myself as a person, not just as a writer.
Yeah, I'm very sorry to hear about your father. So Edith's lover, Hallett, dies in the novel from the virus as well. And I found the description of his physical weakness and the way that Edith is caring for him incredibly moving. He begins to find lesions on his body, and then he enters into a fever and then can't eat or drink and eventually dies. And Edith doesn't really know what to do with the body. There is no all of the normal recourse to calling an ambulance or calling a doctor has completely broken down in the pandemic. It's quite interesting to think about what other viruses kind of hover in the way you write about this virus. Did you find the spectre of HIV or AIDS kind of particularly prevalent in the description?
Yeah, that was certainly there. And I've done a little bit of work around that in my writing previously. You know, I've written short stories around HIV and research into HIV. But also I was thinking about things like cholera, I suppose, Ebola, if it was much more transmissible between humans. Hantavirus, you know, all those things sort of combined to create this spectacularly successful virus that is not just terrible if you contract it in terms of its, you know, its effect on the human body and fatality. But the real issue for these viruses is the kind of stage four transmissibility between humans. So whether it can incubate for a decent amount of time to allow people to travel and give it to other people. And I knew I wanted it to be kind of a systematic illness so that it would kind of, a bit like COVID in that way, it can affect the organs and everything else. But presenting perhaps more like a norovirus that was really, you know, that's really gone to the sort of nth degree and become something absolutely awful. And the idea of the fever as well, this fever is very important. You know, the body reaches this temperature that's either fatal or somehow the victim comes through it and then the virus becomes dormant in the cells again. And we'll come back at a later date. But, you know, heat in the book is very important. So there are these kind of layers of metaphor in there under the title Burnt Coat, the technique that Edith uses to burn wood to kind of make it more resilient, the fever in the body that sort of, you know, brings up to a temperature that either will kill it or make it somehow stronger and able to live with the virus. Those things were really important, and it all kind of came together. The creation of the virus was in some ways sitting alongside the creation of Edith as an artist and the techniques that she uses. In some ways, the kind of heat of passion between the lovers, there's all this hotness that lies in the book that really kind of comes to signify the same thing ultimately.
I really wanted to talk about that passion between the lovers. You, in your other novels and short stories, have always written sex with a really passionate intimacy, and I think it's definitely felt, particularly as you were talking about in Burnt Coat, the heat of it. But what was it like writing about a relationship where there is literally nothing outside of it? Edith and Hallett don't know each other very well, and they go into lockdown together, and all of a sudden their life is reduced to their bed that's above Edith's studio. What was it like writing about sex that when there's nothing really else?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think there's a line in the book somewhere that says, you know, there is a blindness to new lovers anyway. So you end up creating this world between yourselves, which I think is quite true for relationships. Yes, everything else carries on, work and family, but you know, sometimes there's this incredible draw, you know, there's this vortex, and you're brought into this new wonderful relationship and everything else ceases to be outside it. So in some ways, the lockdown is just a physical, political version of that, where they're able to kind of live through what they might be living through anyway, by degrees, at least emotionally. And the body is very important in that context. The body is very important in all my work, but in Burnt Coat, it is about connectivity and love, but also the latter stages, you're right, where Hallett gets ill. It's very physically described, so that you see along the body is used as a spectrum, and it passes, all different kinds of love pass along it. And they only have themselves, yes, they're trapped together. So their bodies become very important. It's a way of connecting. It's a way of building intimacy and the rest of the relationship. So it's not just the physical connection and the passion early on. It's about caring and illness and the breakdown of the human body later on in the book. The same device is used to explore all these different forms of love.
And if we're going to talk about bodies as a form of love, the book begins with Edith remembering her mum, her mother, Naomi, who suffered a stroke when Edith was very young and had to learn how to write, read, walk, talk all over again. And her body is ravaged by something that isn't a virus, but is still an incredibly significant health event. What is the difference writing between something that happens to somebody as one person and one illness and a virus that happens to so many different people? Did you find a tension there?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because there is the collective experience of a pandemic, but then if you're a patient, if you contract the virus, you'll know yourself. You end up kind of locked into this body that's breaking down, and so it might be a shared experience, and there might be societally something that you're going through all together. But the thing itself, if you're hit by it, it's incredibly personal. It's incredibly isolating in some ways. So there's that. And I knew in creating the character of Edith, she was going to have the ingredients of somebody that is and becomes even more resilient. And so that early childhood experience of her mother becoming very ill with a brain injury and having to contend with that complete loss of function and relearning, it's really important in the kind of foundation of building Edith as a character. And she witnesses it in her mother, and she kind of helps her mother through it and has to learn things far quicker than any other child would. So she learns to drive to help her mother. She learns how to, you know, look after the house and get the generator started when they run out, you know, when the electricity goes off, things like that. And I was aware that for a short novel, and it is a short novel, it's, you know, it's 44,000 words, it's very short, you need to pick your ingredients very carefully. So in the making of Edith, I knew that there were going to be certain things that were important to pull in. But I think one of the most important things in relation to the character is the relationship that she has with death in the book. So, you know, lots of the novel is written in the second person, you, and she's addressing Hallett. She's addressing the memory of Hallett. And then you realize towards the end of the novel, she's not just addressing Hallett, she's addressing death. And death has always been around in her life. So while her mother survived this terrible brain injury, she had another weakened blood vessel that meant she might die at any time. So Edith grows up in the shadow of death, knowing that her mother could be taken at any time by it. And at one point, she almost describes it as like a surrogate parent. It's like her father. And I think throughout the book, Edith is having to come to terms with mortality in the people that she loves, but also herself. And then finally, Hallett is with her and dying in the room. And she this is where the switch happens. And you finally realize that she's talking to death through Hallett. And that's been really the keyhole for her into that other domain of nothingness. And it's quite a nihilistic book, not nihilistic, it's a humanist book, let's say. There's no afterlife in it. There's just the void. There's just the end and the change of matter. And that's really key to Edith. Yeah. It's these stages of her coming to accept mortality.
Yeah, and you're talking about when you finally realise she's talking to death. And it's an incredibly emotional moment. I was reading it and suddenly it hits you like it just hits you so hard. Yeah, it's incredibly emotional.
Yeah, she kind of crawls across the mat, doesn't she? And she sort of holds on to her dead lover, but it's death that's embracing her. So there's this, and again, it's kind of strangely paternal in some ways and odd, but yeah.
And that reach for the bodily as well is incredibly, incredibly strong, I think, with so Edith has a lover when she is at art school as well. And the way you describe their bodily relationship is incredibly interesting as well. There isn't a relationship in the book that isn't kind of predicated on touch, mm-hmm. or as a quite an awful moment where her other boyfriend ends up urinating on her mother in a way. Yeah. And there's just this awful confluence of bodily fluids in so many different ways in the novel, which is also brilliant.
Yeah, and I suppose I've always regarded human beings not just as human beings but human animals, because we are. So, you know, while we have this incredible cognitive function or functions, we are still sort of biological machinery as well. And that's very interesting to me, the sort of bringing it back to the flesh and the bone and the matter and the instinct. So yes, you're right, all the characters in some way are connected through their bodies, whether that's positive or negative. I do think it's mostly positive. And again, coming back to the sex. So I think, you know, there are these bad experiences in the book that Edith has, but I was very keen to kind of present sexual relationships as positive and wholesome and fortifying and exciting and something that's nutritious to the body and nutritious to the self. You know, it's almost like there's a trend for kind of writing negatively about sex, particularly in relation to women, and they get stuck in these kind of situations where, yes, bad experiences happen, and they do, and that's unfortunate, and we really need to work harder to kind of, you know, minimize that or get rid of it. But what I'm interested in are the levels beyond that, you know, how we choose to move forward, how we process these things as individuals and move out of perhaps victimhood and into another realm. So I am interested in these capable, resilient female characters. You know, that's not always available to us in life, but certainly it's an area that I'm interested in exploring because I don't like the idea that women are limited.
And neither Edith nor Naomi accepts victimhood in any of their predicaments. Naomi with her incredible brain injury and Edith with all of the relationship difficulties that she has as well. I think that's really, really brilliantly done in the novel.
Yeah, that's right. And towards the end of the book, Edith's having a conversation with her agent and her, they're just kind of joking around and talking about her mother, I think. And there's one point, I think, where the agent says to, you know, says to Edith, well, you know, this, you know, the concept of a woman, what do you think about that? And Edith says, I just don't understand what that is, you know, as if she's not limited by her gender. She's not limited by anything. Her experiences are so far beyond that kind of definition. She's moved into all these other realms. And I quite like that about her. I like the fact that she doesn't even recognize the concept of a woman.
Yeah, so brilliantly, powerfully done. I wanted to ask about, you were talking earlier about how Edith ends up speaking to death, and there's a concern with the novel with memorialising after death in a way. There's a very emotional moment where Edith speaks to Hallett's family on the phone and then gives them back his possessions. She parcels them up and she keeps his coffee bean grinder as a kind of memorial to him in a way, and she thinks it's kind of theft, but she wants to keep it. And then Naomi dies when Edith is training in Japan to do her sculptures in wood, and there's a sense that I don't know, I got a palpable sense that she was creating one thing as her mother was dying. And then right at the end of the novel, Edith is asked to do a memorial for all the victims of the virus. Did you feel like writing in the wake of so many deaths and a pandemic as well, you were also memorializing it in a way? Is there something there?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the central concerns of the book. So it was one of my concerns. What use is art in the face of these things, in the face of so much death? You know, you see these war memorials everywhere that are a list of names and are usually quite a young male soldier. And it's supposed to be representative of all these experiences and all these losses. And they don't fulfill, really, in some ways. They're wonderful and they're thoughtful and sensitive. It's interesting, isn't it? There are big discussions about how to memorialize things now, like the 9/11, basically the World Trade Center, whether that's been sensitively done. And I think it has been sensitively done. Germany, especially, you know, the kind of sensitivity around memorials there, they have to be well thought through, really well thought through. And it's such pressure on an artist and artists to somehow say, I'm going to approach this subject that was so big and so devastating and somehow reflect us within it. So that was one of my concerns. What use is this novel going to be other than companionable for readers in this time, in this age? What use is art, basically? What can it do? It's all about the relics of humanity, isn't it? The whole history of art. It's just the relics of love, the relics of human existence. What meaning do these things have later? Unless, you know, other humans are kind of looking at it and thinking, oh yeah, that was significant and that's symbolic and that's how that's been done. But ultimately, you know, they kind of end up being, you know, just things. So it's very tricky. It is very tricky. I mean, I think we do reach for these things, don't we? We reach for art. We reach for novels. We reach for short stories and anything, and songs as a way of commemorating and understanding and not being consoled exactly again, but just having something of the past that's meaningful, you know, not letting everything go in a kind of meaningless way. But it's incredibly hard. It's very, very difficult subject matter. And I've kind of tackled it before, but this book is particularly preoccupied with it. And Edith doesn't even really understand what she's doing sometimes. So she builds this huge sculpture called Heki on the Scotch Corner traffic junction, which is a bit like a feminist version of the Angel of the North. And so she's asked so many questions about this piece because it sort of gains her this sort of infamy and respect as well. And she can't really answer the question. Well, I created it, but I don't really know what it is. I'm a conduit for something. I hope you find something of it meaningful for you, but I'm not actually the person to tell you exactly what this is. And I like that about Edith, because I also feel that you create these things. You hope they connect with people, but you don't necessarily have a handle on what exactly it is you've created or why.
I think that's really, really, really the kind of the difficulty of writing about art and the power that it has after such a disaster as well. And I wanted to ask about, I think you kind of answered it in a way, the difficulty of writing about a different art medium. If you're a novelist, how does it feel writing about a sculptor, and not just like a small scale sculptor? She is wrestling with huge materials and everything. Is there a sense that you're wrestling with words on a page? I don't know. It's less physical, isn't it? Even if we like to use that metaphor.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So I have a background in art history, and I have written about the arts quite a lot. And in some ways, I don't know whether it's wish fulfillment. I wish I was creating these immense sculptures. I can kind of see them like in my mind's eye. I'm sort of constructing them. And I have also felt, strange as it may sound, that literature, that writing is making. So there's something very physical about it for me. Words are very physical, they're very textured. This is probably a background in poetry. But I've always felt that you are actually constructing something dimensional with words. You know, they look very simple on the page and very small, and it's black and white, and it's not the same. It's not visually the same. But the visual trick in the imagination of the reader is there. So you do need to create a monumental sculpture. You need to have the exact right words to describe it, or describe it well enough that somebody, it will spring to life in somebody else's imagination. And it is really hard, but it's just one step away from actually making it, I think. That's how it often feels to me. And I'm in no way an artist, but it feels like there's one door to pass through. And if you can kind of do it in words, then that's wonderful. And it was very important that Edith was going to be a land artist, because it's a very masculine field in the history of art. There aren't that many women that have kind of become large scale land artists. And I like that. I like that she was taking up space. She was taking up space in that field, and also her work is taking up space.
Yeah, she made me think of Barbara Hepworth, but I'm not sure if that was just an unconscious.
Yeah, on steroids.
Just huger. And then, because often Barbara Hepworth is associated with making quite feminine forms that aren't particularly obviously feminine in a way, that description of Heki made me think of, because she's also a brilliant northern character in a way.
I mean, yeah, not, Yorkshire, Scotland, Park, but Yorkshire. I was thinking about that, and these huge things. I like that Edith arrives at burnt wood as a medium. She uses all kinds of woods, but so, you know, this burning technique does preserve the wood so that you don't need to kind of treat it with chemicals or anything else, and it will last for millennium. And I really like that, because she's kind of destroying to create something, and it's a very strange counterintuitive thing that she's doing. And she's making these huge sculptures, but actually they are less durable than stone, perhaps. I mean, sometimes not, you know, burnt wood does last for a long time, and fossilized wood, when you find it in a bog, can last, you know, thousands and thousands of years. But that was quite nice, that tension between how she makes what she does and the things that she's actually making. And they are quite provocative, you know, in a way that sometimes sculpture isn't, you know, particularly public art, you know, because you have to get through all these layers of, is it acceptable? Will you get the commission? Are you going to horrify people? To what point can you provoke? You really have to walk a fine line, I think, there. And I think she really pushes the boundary. I love that about her as a character. She's, you know, she's sort of confrontational.
Yeah, I wish we could have an Edith Hartnell sculpture as a COVID memorial.
I know, I can see it. Every time I drive past Scotch Corner, you know, the kind of like the traffic island there with the trees, I just think, yeah, come on, that would be absolutely brilliant. Welcome to the North.
Yeah, be strong, it'd be brilliant, yeah. So you wrote this in the first lockdown, and it was published just this winter. Are you writing anything else kind of inspired by current events, or are you moving on to other types of projects?
I'm still kind of hooked into all the promotion for the book and things, so don't feel like I'm fully able to move on to the next thing. I do have another couple of things on the go, so there tends to be something hovering around or actually, you know, clicking away. But yeah, I mean, the book was out very recently and it was written in a really compressed way. So I think, you know, I started writing it in March 2020 and it was out October of last year. So that's pretty quick. You know, I've done that before. It's not completely unusual for me, but it felt like a very, very intense experience because of the nature of the book as well. And it's been a very, very intense couple of years. So I'm also sort of PTSD kind of coming out of the whole experience, and you know, I think we all do, don't we? We're just sort of sitting there going, what the hell is going on? What was that? And I think, you know, for decades I think people are going to be looking back on this and trying to metabolize it and figure out, you know, exactly how they feel about it and the effect that it's had on them. So I feel like it's okay to have a bit of space after this book, I think.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.